that are using the loop seriously, a lot of them on 160 and 75 meters, are using balance beam. So what came up with it is a type of tuna, which in a way is a cousin to another form of matching networks, of L networks. And basically what we're using here is two rotary inductive tuners, you know, the rotary type that the wheel rides on a coil as you turn it, and then a variable capacitor across the output point. The input point contains the vallum, the choke vallum is at the input rather than at the output. Basically, that's the description. That's where a lot of people can't quite understand what the heck we're doing. Maybe you can explain basically how this works, better than, I don't know how really to phrase it, but the depiction circuit. Input vallum to two rotary inductors with one tuning capacitor across the output of the two to a balanced feed, Dick, over.
My goodness, there's a long delay there. There's a number of different ways of doing this. And by the way, Balun is either spelled E-A-L-U-N, Baker, Alpha, Lima, Uniform, November, and sometimes there's a double U in there. It is a contraction of balance and unbalanced. That's what it's doing. It's doing a conversion between something that's called unbalanced, that means coax cable, and something that's balanced, which usually means twin lead. 300 ohm, 600 ohm, open wire line, 450 ohm line. Those are balanced lines. The great advantage of balanced line is it's usually made of a wide, large conductor, pieces of copper that are pretty strong. You can hang it at the catenary. Sometimes you don't have to support it in the middle. And it's got extremely low loss. So it's strong, high power, low loss. Not too expensive, and can be homebrewed. That's the good news about open wire line. The bad news is that you have to use the antenna tuner in a slightly different manner. Most antenna tuners are designed to be coax in and coax out. There's not as many antenna tuners that are made to have a link coupling or something like that, a built-in balance or a link coupling, which is made to feed open wire line. Let me drop. And so, if you're smart enough as an antenna manufacturer, antenna designer, antenna creator, and if you want to build something like Mel's full wavelength square loop antenna that's 40 feet in the air, and I think it contains something like 260 feet of wire around the perimeter, an 80 meter full wavelength loop 40 feet in the air. And I believe he's feeding it with something like 600 ohm open wire line. And because the 600 ohm open wire line from the feed point of that loop is so low in loss, there is no advantage of him doing any impedance matching right at the antenna to open line junction. He can do all the impedance matching at the other end. And one approach he could have used, if he wanted to, is to take his antenna tuner, which could have been the coax input and coax output type, and on the output he takes the coax cable and makes a so-called half-wave coax balance. It's just a U-shaped piece of coax cable, half-wavelength long, and you bring all the shields together and take your coax cable out of the antenna tuner. Then a conductor feeds one end of that U-shaped piece of coax cable, and now those two center conductors of the U-shaped piece of cable feed the open wire line. It is a 4-to-1 impedance step up, a 2-to-1 voltage increase, 4-to-1 impedance step up, thoroughly balanced structure. It takes the unbalanced output of your antenna tuner and makes it a proper feed for the balanced open wire line, the 600 ohm line, if that's what you're using. That's one possible way of doing it. Mel went the next step. He made the more elaborate version of an L network or T network in his antenna tuner, which now more directly feeds that open wire line. making some guesses here, Mel, and you can correct me on that one. H-U-K-E-Y, H-U-R-I-W. A very successful arrangement you've got there, by the way.
Yeah, it seems to be very popular with the people that use these full-wave loops that are about 272 feet in circumference. The point is that with this type of tuning arrangement using two rotary inductors, you can really get a very good balance feed into your line. And basically, I would say that actually what you're doing is tuning the antenna. Can I say that? Can I actually say that I am actually tuning the antenna at the shack level, Dick, rather than, say, putting something up that there may be some kind of a, you know, remote control type of electronic tuners now that they're producing that you can hang up at the antenna. But I think possibly I'm getting the same effect by doing it from the shack, that I'm tuning the antenna from the shack, I believe, by this method. Would you say that's a true statement? Over.
Tune it up at the antenna, not at the shack.
Okay, no. I think Mel is right on this one, Alex. When you want to radiate from an antenna, when you want to transmit, I am positive to radiate efficiently, you resonate first, then you have the ability to radiate. You must resonate the network first. But what do we mean by resonate? You're resonating the radiating system. The system consists of antenna, usually a transmission line to the antenna, maybe an antenna tuner, almost always a final tank circuit in the transmitter itself, plus the tube that's creating the power, if it's being done with a tube or a transistor. You resonate that total system, transmitting tube or transistor, tank circuit, antenna tuner, feed line, and antenna. That total system has to be resonated. Now, the purest among people think that all resonating must take place in the antenna itself. There's a degree of truth in that. If you want to use lossy transmission line, and if you want the transmission line to run at very low standing wave ratio, so you don't get additional loss factors in that transmission line, then yes, you're going to build some kind of a remote tuning arrangement, remotely controlled tuning arrangement, right up at the antenna. But for a guy who's smart enough to run low enough loss open wire line, where the line has got a tenth of a dB of loss if it was perfectly matched, and 3/10 of a dB of loss if it's not perfectly matched, which is negligible, almost nothing, you can do 99.9% of all of the resonating in the shack. You're resonating a radiating system. Those words I just said, without a doubt, are controversial. You say that on Saturday afternoon on 20 meters, and you'll get 50 guys climbing down your throat saying, you're absolutely wrong, and if you keep saying it, I'm going to shoot you. Well, say something that's wrong. Walt Maxwell, W2DU, let me drop, was working for the RCA Astro Division in, I think it was Princeton, New Jersey, working on the Tyros satellite at 136 megacycles. He had this tape dipole antenna on the outside of the satellite. All the engineers he worked with said, you've got to resonate the antenna right there on the outside of the satellite. He says, no, I don't have to. I've got these feed lines coming from the outside of the satellite, way out there on the perimeter. I bring those feed lines down to the transmitting stage, and I resonate the antenna there. A bunch of his engineers said, that's not the way I was taught in my school. You can't do it that way. Walt says, the laws of physics will let me do it that way. Try it. You'll like it. He built it that way. They put it in the chamber. They tested it, and their jaws dropped. They said, holy blank. How the hell does that thing work so well when you're not resonating the antenna? Walt was smart enough, W2DU, who's written a whole bunch of books that you can buy called Reflections on Reflections. You can buy them from the QSC magazine, from ARRL. He does a pretty good job in some people's minds of explaining the real meaning of standing wave ratio and transmission line. He did all the matching back at the transmitter, the convenient place. his fellow engineers thought it would crash and burn. It flew like a chomp. Tyrus was an extremely successful project, and those engineers were humbled, and they learned a couple of brand new lessons. That's where Mel is. He's got a feed line that's low enough and lost. He's resonating his radiating system, and he's within the laws of physics. He's not violating any of them to do it in the shack very efficiently. You may want to give me some rebuttal on that one, Alex. You got it, Alex. KQRIW.
Well, I knew all those arguments, and if you want to really go to the extreme, then you need two antenna tuners, because the feed line, which is usually a coax cable, resonates only on one single frequency. So that you have two planes to match, the input of the feed cable and the output of the feed cable. So if the feed cable for this frequency is resonating with this antenna tuner, that doesn't mean that it will resonate also, or it will match the antenna itself. So you need a second antenna tuner at the antenna itself. But because I'm a lazy guy, I will consider always that because radio is a 50 ohm and the coax is a 50 ohm, I have only to create 50 ohm at the other end where the antenna is. But if you really want to get picky, then you need two antenna tuners. One on the antenna, one on the input of the cable. This is my opinion. After 40 years in RF, M to NNU.
Let me challenge Alex to hear a little bit further. What you said, Alex, is the right answer for a purist. A man who really wants the system to be perfect. And he's got lots of money, lots of time, lots of resources, and he wants to do it right. I'm going to agree with you. The antenna tuner, a lossless antenna tuner with high efficiency, mounted right at the antenna, so that your feed line is happy with its characteristic impedance. Your antenna is happy with its characteristic impedance, and then if maybe another antenna tuner where the feed line meets the transmitter. That's the purest way. But if your feed line is low enough and long, and if you do all of the antenna tuning in the shack and do none of it at the antenna, if I'm running 600 ohm open wire line, but my antenna happens to be 47 ohm of resistance and maybe some reactance, some crazy number is the real antenna impedance. And now my open wire line is running at a rather high standing wave ratio. Assuming that loss is a low number and I can tolerate it, and now I do all of the antenna tuning with one tuner in the shack. In that environment, Alex, tell me in your mind, what is the disadvantage of me doing what you call the lazy way? If I do it that way, and if my antenna open wire line is low enough and lost, do I suffer a disadvantage to do that? Over to you, Alex.
Oh, yeah, a fundamental disadvantage. You will have to buy a new laptop immediately. With all those wires that go into the laptop, you're going to burn out all the input into the laptop because your feeder will radiate a lot. Especially when your radio shack is not properly grounded, it is at a first level, first floor like mine. But as you said, we are not all purists, and we have money for new laptops, so that's how it goes.
Okay, before I go back to Glenn, I'm going to challenge Alex one more time. And you've given the right answer if there was unbalance in the way I'm using the open wire line. In the case of Mel's loop antenna, a thoroughly balanced antenna, which, by the way, he intentionally feeds unbalanced and sometimes balanced and a mixture of the two. I'm not going to go there yet. Assuming the antenna is a thoroughly balanced structure, and assuming that the open wire line is a thoroughly balanced open wire line being properly fed in a balanced manner from the tuner in the shack. The fact that my open wire line is being used in a thoroughly balanced symmetric manner, even though it has high VISWAR, it does not radiate. If I have a common mode current flowing on that open wire line, yes, it's going to radiate like crazy. If I manage to keep the signal on that open wire line thoroughly balanced, It is so well shielded. 60 dB down is its radiation. Because I'm running with a very high VISRAR, my radiation is only 57 dB down instead of 60. To me, that is very well shielded. To me, it does not radiate. Standing wave ratio itself, as long as you're using the open wire line in a thoroughly balanced manner, standing wave ratio itself does not create radiation. I know that if I say these words on 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon, a lot of people are going to get angry with me. This is a extremely strongly held opinion that everyone just sends that opinion downrange and doesn't question it. Open wire, balanced transmission line with high VISRAR, for all practical purposes, does not radiate. I'm giving you an opportunity to challenge that one, Alex. Over to you, sir. K2LIW.
I will not challenge that because this is true, but I was not talking about the transmission line. What you are doing, Dick, is using the open line as a transmission line, and no transmission line, when it is balanced, is radiating. That is something that everybody knows. You don't have to have a challenge on that. If you remember, I said we are using a coax cable like everybody else here, and an antenna tuner between the coax cable to the radio. And now we're going up to an antenna that might or might not be balanced. It is bound to have some current into the coax cable. And that's what I was saying. This is a threat to your computer. If you're not cleaning up, remember the problems I had with my antenna? Okay. The problem has been solved by just redesigning the balloon. But otherwise, if you don't match the antenna, symmetrical antenna to an asymmetrical transmission line, then you will have problems. And the matching must be exactly and perfect. This is what I said. I didn't talk about open line, which is not used by many people because most of us are living in dwellings that do not permit something like that. Okay, sorry for that. And 20 minutes.
Good information. And now, if I feed that antenna with coax cable, an unbalanced cable, and it's running high as well, if I put a good enough balancing device, not an antenna tuner, a balancing device at the intersection of that transmission line and the antenna, I think I can stop that transmission line from radiating, even though it's running a high standing wave ratio. I will admit that as the standing wave ratio gets higher and higher, the requirement for that balancing device at the antenna becomes more and more stringent. It's got to be a balancing device that's got a lot of hair in its chest. You run a kilowatt through a balance at, let's say, 160 meters, which is running a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. Unless you bought a very good balance, you probably have spoken plain. I'm going to agree with you on that one. But the standing wave ratio itself doesn't necessarily create radiation of a transmission line. A lot of people think it does. Now, Glenn wanted to make some words out of order. Glenn, you got the floor. K2RIW.
Hi,
it's
first, I just want to say good evening to you, Dick, and Annette. Just a quick comment from my experience using both coax and using the balanced feed line. The balanced feed line, you're right, you know, by definition, they really don't radiate tremendously to the point where it's a problem. Although, you know, some of the mounting considerations, you know, keeping them away from metal objects and possibly winding them in a helix and kind of, wrap them around a little bit so that they don't interfere with other items. But one of the setbacks that I found that especially when the characteristics of the compete and the antenna starts going to a higher VSWR, aside from using the balance at the end of the antenna, another area of concern, too, that you might just want to keep your eyes open on is the connection where you go to your tuner. Because the voltage variation there is also, I found by experimentation, a place of radiation where when you have your transceiver and you're tuning that box right there, sometimes it takes some special consideration for the voltages that are on that are feeding that feed line right at that point during tuning, especially away from the center frequency of your antenna.
Yeah, I think the nice way to do it, for physical layout reasons, because most antenna tuners are made for coax in and coax out, is to run a coax cable out of the antenna tuner, bring it outside of the house, put a small hole in the wall, so to speak, and then put the half-wave coax balun or some other kind of baluning device that picks up the open wire line. Yeah, I agree with you that the junction of the open wire line and the coax cable can easily be a point of radiation. And if that's a foot away from your transceiver and a foot away from your computer, that can give you grief. And running open wire line through insulators to go through the wall of the house is a bit difficult. Bell does it by buying these porcelain igniter devices that are intended for an oil burner, which has got a 10,000 volt rating. And a pair of those going through the wall is a beautiful way of getting open wire line from the outside of the house into the house. But an awful lot of guys think it's mechanically a little bit nicer to run the coax cable out of the house. It's a short run. And then the real length outside is the open wire line with the balancing device on the outside of the house. And now that junction, which is a kind of a radiating junction, is far away from your equipment, and by the inverse square law, gives you a lot less grief. I wonder if you consider doing it that way sometimes. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. And here again, this is just an experience. What I found seems to work best for me. I'll use coaxial cave entrance points that I've made on the side of the house, which used to be a vent opening, and I moved the vent to another location, used that opening, and made like a piece of aluminum diamond plate as a bulkhead between the entrance of where my coaxial cable comes into the house and exits at that point. And from there, I run a ground from there into earth ground directly beside the house. And then basically I drill the hole and put the see-through connectors right there at that bulkhead. But that's also a location where I've also placed a balun at that point. So I mean, like do my 4-to-1, my 1-to-1 there as well. So if I want wire feeding, the wire feeding junction going from the ladder line is starting from the outside of the house as opposed to the inside of the house. KC2QIQ, H4IW, KC2QIQ, thank you.
Raise this on your question, Dick and Glenn.
Alex, recognize. Yeah, Glenn, that sounds like a nice physical arrangement you've got. Okay, go ahead with your question, Alex.
Yeah, no, I have nothing else to do here but listening to you guys and wondering why my computer works so slow. Anyhow, as we know, a wave, when it hits an obstacle, it deposits energy in that obstacle. For example, a water wave, it does, when it hits a stone, it will try to tumble the stone. Energy of the wave is transferred to the stone and so forth. A standing wave goes up and down. It will hit a wall also, somewhere. This is why it is produced in the first place. Where is this energy going, Dick?
Okay. To a person who uses a Bird wattmeter, one of the very convenient ways of measuring standing wave ratio of an antenna system is to measure the amount of forward power and reverse power. And if you've got a real good antenna system, the power coming back is about 20 decibels weaker, 100-to-1 ratio, compared to what goes out. 100 watts goes out, 1 watt comes back. Of the 1 watt that comes back, or if you've got a real high standing wave ratio, 50 watts comes back. You could be sending out 100 watts and 50 watts will come back. And after you adjust your antenna tuner, and you've got your Bird watt meter on the far side of the antenna tuner, on the antenna side, you might discover 150 watts coming forward and 50 watts coming back, even though the transmitter is only turning out 100 watts. You'd be amazed how many people have been amazed with that one. I've been perplexed by that one. Of all the energy that comes back from the antenna into your antenna tuner, it looks like the antenna tuner is correcting the reflected energy because the transmitter side sees a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio when the antenna tuner is set correctly. of that reflected energy. The antenna tuner can absorb none of it. The transmitter, which is a nearly constant current generator, can absorb none of it. The feed line, if it's properly running as a shielded structure, can radiate none of it. So therefore, it's not being radiated, it's not being absorbed. It's being re-reflected forward. When you're adjusting the tuning and loading control on that transmitter, if it's got enough range, or on the antenna tuner, which gives you more range, that's all it really is, in the tank circuit with more tuning range, that's all an antenna tuner is. When you adjust that tuning and loading control correctly, you think you're getting the best power output from the transmitter. And yes, you are. You think you're getting a good impedance match between the final stage of the transmitter and the antenna feed line. To a degree, you are. But what you didn't realize you were doing simultaneously when you adjusted that tuning and loading control, so that the transmitter, let me drop, so that the transmitter had the right current of the final stage, and it's in resonance, you dipped the final, so to speak, and it's in resonance. What you didn't realize you were doing is that you were making the tank circuit or the antenna tuner present just the right impedance to the feed line, so that the energy coming back down from the antenna gets re-reflected forward, every bit of it gets re-reflected forward. Not only is it re-reflected forward, it's re-reflected forward in a way that is exactly in phase with the energy that the transmitter is producing at this time. So if your line is lossless, if your antenna tuner is lossless, if you properly adjusted it, even though you've got a fiercely high standing wave ratio on that antenna, every one of those 100 watts you're transmitting, almost all of them get out that antenna. Yeah, the feed line is very busy feeding all that energy, bouncing back and forth multiple times. But there's only one place where it can be dissipated, the antenna itself. Everything else, by definition, is shielded and lossless. Energy once created cannot be destroyed. It can be converted to some other form, like heat, if you've got loss. But the only thing that can really dissipate it is the radiation resistance of the antenna. It's got to be radiated into space somewhere near that antenna. You'd be amazed how many people are positive that all of the reflected energy going into an antenna tuner gets wasted. People make the mistake of thinking that takes place. You can put your hand on an antenna tuner, and if it's a good one, it runs ice cold. You can put your sniffing device near that antenna tuner. If it's properly shielded, it's not radiating any signal. There's only one other thing that can happen. It's re-reflecting it forward, out that antenna. That's the ideal world. Back to you, Alex. K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. Here is the puzzlement. Think about time. First second, we inject some power into the antenna, we get a reflected power of 50 watts. And you're telling me that goes back and forth between the two, between the two planes of reference. So this is the first second. Now the second second, the transmitter is pumping a new power in, and another 50 watts are now flying around back and forth, back and forth. How come we are not accumulating reflected power in the cable? By doing the integration on the, over time, you should be seeing accumulation of power on it, no?
A good guess, but no. Every antenna you and I have ever used, Alex, has got a finite Q. That 80-meter dipole, full half-wave dipole I may be using, really has a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, maybe between 3.5 and 3.75 megacycles. That's where it's 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. And a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, something like 10% of the power is being reflected. And when I go up even further to 4 megacycles, maybe I'm going to get a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio. And maybe 30% of my power is reflected. The antenna has a transient impedance when you first turn it on. But it also has a steady state impedance. This power reflected back and forth is taking place in microseconds. When you and I press down that key to send high-speed Morse code, we're holding down that key for many milliseconds. As far as this energy bouncing back and forth is concerned, the amount of time that you're holding it down allows it to come up to steady state response, steady state performance. That energy bounces back and forth, and it eventually settles on a certain rate of reflected energy, a certain rate of forward energy, a certain percentage of it that's radiated, 98% of it radiated. It's got a good system. So there's a steady state performance and a transient performance. That first wave that hits the antenna the very first time sees a different impedance. That antenna has a finite Q. Q means it's got stored energy. It's like a flywheel. The first time I push on that push rod of that flywheel on my steam engine, so to speak, that wheel is not spinning yet. It's got a locked rotor condition. It's got a very low impedance until I get that flywheel moving. Once that flywheel is up to speed, I get a very different impedance. I call it the steady state impedance. The antenna is like that. The antenna is a kind of a flywheel. It's closer to a short circuit when you first get that first microsecond of signal. The first leading edge of that signal hitting the antenna sees a very different impedance, and quite a bit gets reflected, even if there was a good impedance match. At first, there's a reflection. Later on, it comes up to steady state response. It takes a few microseconds to do that. But I'm going to press down the key for quite a few milliseconds. I got plenty of time to come up to steady state response. And it's a steady state response that really counts. You could call it an infinite series equation if you wanted to solve it really the right way. It is a kind of an infinite series equation as to what is the steady state response of reflected energy on a transmission line. And even if my antenna was a perfect 50 ohm antenna and I got perfect 50 ohm transmission line, that first microsecond that hit the antenna does not see 50 ohms. The stored energy is not there yet. The flywheel
repeater, timeout, cancel.
In that first fraction of a microsecond, the flywheel is not up to speed. The antenna is not 50 ohms until it reaches steady state response. In that first microsecond, that antenna might be a 3 ohm impedance. And there's a lot of reflected energy in the very beginning, even for a so-called perfectly impedance match antenna. That's one of the effects of Q. And the four definitions of Q, one of them is 3 dB bandwidth divided by center frequency, center frequency divided by 3 dB bandwidth. That's one definition. Stored energy over dissipated energy is another definition. Voltage rise at resonance is another definition. Current rise at resonance is another. There's four definitions of Q. They're all representing the stored energy of the equivalent of a flywheel. Once an antenna is really running, it is a kind of a flywheel, except for an antenna that's extremely broadband, like a leaky 50 ohm resistor. That's the only kind of antenna that's got a Q that's very, very low. Every other antenna you and I have ever used, except for a rhombic or a beverage, is a standing wave structure. In the wire of the dipole itself, the energy is bouncing back and forth 20 times before it gets radiated. I got a 72 ohm impedance, perfectly resonated dipole. I'm feeding it with 72 ohm twin lead. Looks like a perfect impedance match. In the wire of the dipole itself, it's running at a 20 to 1 standing wave ratio. That energy is bouncing back and forth 20 times before the magnetic field is radiated into space. And resonance is defined as me keeping all of those bounces in step with each other. I don't know of any book that explains it this way, Alex. Maybe you and I should write one. NNU, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KP2QIQ with one more comment.
Glenn recognized Alex first. You got it, Alex.
Okay, most of what you said, it's known to everybody around here. I think that there is more to the antenna tuner that we die. But we're going to leave it for another time now because this computer here is getting really me on the verge of getting crazy. And I need another coffee, and that is quite late for that. So one thing I can say that somehow that leaky wave that actually appears as a reflected wave gain is part of the answer that I was kind of expecting, but that's another story for another time. Okay, Dick, thank you so much. I have to run. This is not a good day for me here today. Have fun there, all of you, Antoine, and you have to run.
I just remember, Alex, those guys from the FSU, former Soviet Union, are pretty tough. So they're not going to let some little old computer get them down. Hang in there. Glenn, you got it.
Yes, Dick, just another thing, just tracing down a lot of EMI problems with, using antenna tuners, we'll just outside the band of, let's say, a loop antenna or other antennas in general. One of the problems that I've found is not so much that the feed line radiates or the tuner itself is radiating, but one of the kinds of problems that I've found is that I'll wind up with a voltage divider in the ground. In other words, where the ground current by the transceiver will start to pick up and increase as opposed to out close to the antenna. Do you have any words on that one? Because a lot of it, I've tried to model it sometimes and haven't had a tremendous amount of success, but I have measured the effect where as you go outside the band of the normal tuning, the VSWR can still be corrected. And if you sniff around and you measure the feed line isn't what's radiating or the tuner itself, but around the transceiver, the current into the local ground sometimes increases, and that creates an EMI. Back to you, Dick. Keep your tube directed.
Yeah, once we query Mel on this subject, I think he's going to tell you something about this. Mel has discovered by his more elaborate antenna tuner that he has created, where he basically has an antenna tuner on the left-hand side and an antenna tuner on the right-hand side of his open wire line that allows him to independently control differential current and common mode current. If I'm feeding open wire line, and if I'm feeding it in a thoroughly balanced manner, if at this instant of time I pump 1 ampere into the right-hand wire and take exactly 1 ampere out of the left-hand wire, in theory there is no current flowing to ground. It's thoroughly balanced. That's the ideal world. Now let's get to the real world. The real world, you're feeding a loop antenna up in the air. Some portion of the loop is coming closer to a tree than the other portion of the loop. The right-hand side of the loop has now got extra stray capacitance to ground. All of a sudden, the loop antenna itself is not a thoroughly balanced mode. Load. Even if I feed the open wire line in a thoroughly balanced manner, because the antenna itself is slightly unbalanced, it is now creating a reflective current into the open wire line of a common mode nature. You're trying to pump 1 ampere into the right-hand wire and take 1 ampere out of the left-hand wire, and if the antenna was thoroughly balanced, that would work like a charm. There would never be any current flowing to ground. So even if the system in the shack and the balancing structure is perfect, you can still end up with unbalanced current because of the antenna. But now if you go to the next step where Mel has been, where he discovers that if he chooses the right ratio of differential current, he's not changing frequency. Say he's at 3.7 megs. He's using a certain ratio of differential current and a certain ratio of common mode current. He's controlling the polarization of what's being radiated by that antenna. Depending on the state of the ionosphere today, there's a desirable polarization that gives him the best performance, whether he's transmitting or receiving. Two separate performances, by the way. Two separate tunings. We'll go there right now. So, I can create an intentional imbalance in the way I feed the antenna. Mel's been there. And even if I intentionally try to make it perfectly balanced, the antenna itself can be imbalanced. Because unless you've got a really pristine environment, guaranteed some portion of that loop antenna in the air is seeing a different amount of stray capacitance to ground from a local tree than some other portion. That's a guess on my part, Glenn. KT2QIQ, KQLIW.
Yeah, Dick, that's exactly what I found. And one of the things that in experimenting and playing around with that is that I started taking two antenna tuners and tried to create a differential type of I started off with two differentials to create a common mode tuning system, and what it did was it completely changed the pattern of the antenna. In other words, I got to the point where I could eliminate the ground current down by the transceiver and balance it out, but the pattern was completely different. Sometimes the switch in the antenna wasn't usable anymore. I guess just to simplify things, I kind of have to agree with Alex a little bit that if you're starting up putting up an antenna, really you want to cut it as close to the center frequency as possible and feed everything down, but don't be afraid to use the antenna tuners, but I think you always have to be, you know, open and aware that there are going to be some kind of issues and things you might have to play with. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
You may have given up a little bit too soon, Alex. When you used your differential tuner in such a way that you made the current going into the grounding structure go to zero, do you now have the right imbalance in the way you fed the antenna, which made it compatible with the imbalance of the antenna itself? Yes, you now radiated a brand new pattern, and you thought the antenna was useless. Yes, it was useless for those particular people you had struck up that conversation with. You're now radiating a different pattern and a different polarization. And I'll bet you there was a day of the year, an hour of the day, and a frequency, and a direction of arrival, a state of the ionosphere, where that particular mode that you thought was useless was very useful. I think Mel discovered that there were different amounts of differential current versus common mode current that were ideal for a particular day. And it's not necessarily the same tuning for another day. Correspondingly, when he has that small loop antenna in the shack with him, where now he can tilt it in azimuth, elevation, and rotate it in polarization, he found out that because that 80-meter signal bouncing up the ionosphere, because of Faraday's rotation characteristics, that's when you've got, we drop. My goodness, it takes a long time to reset. I'm not going to wait. The ionosphere is a plasma. It's a plasma with a magnetic field. Therefore, it does do Faraday rotation. You launch a horizontal signal. It goes to the ionosphere and twists a few times. Ends up vertical when it goes to your buddy in London. And when he sends back a vertical signal, you'd like to think it's going to end up horizontal in New York. It may end up vertical again. Faraday rotation doesn't obey reciprocity. But the Faraday rotation today, state of the ionosphere and state of the magnetic field, and the number of twists it gets, there's an ideal polarization that you can set. And Mel has discovered that when he has his loop in the shack with him. And when you're feeding differential current and common mode current into a loop antenna with open wire line, you're doing some of that experimentation. You have some degree of variability of what you radiate in polarization. You can adjust your antenna tuners in such a way you're getting a good standing wave ratio. The 100 watts you're creating is not going into the antenna tuner. He's running ice cold. They're not radiating very much of it locally. It's all going into the feed line. Some of it are common mode, some of it differential mode, and there's nothing left for it to be radiated by except the antenna. It's going somewhere in the space. A particular group of guys you were talking to during that previous conversation probably didn't like that particular polarization. If you thought the antenna was useless, it might not have been. I wonder if you ever saw a situation, Glenn, where that exact set of settings that you thought were useless at some other point of time, some other day, some other group of guys in some other direction, they would get a darn good signal from you in that mode of operation. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I guess the answer to that one is no. But there again, you know, how much time have I really spent trying to do that? I really can't say that I've done enough experimentation to really prove that out. But in most general applications, you know, especially with the wire antennas, usually the, you know, once I get an antenna that's giving me generally good performance, there is conditions during climb, but it's not something where just myself loses conditions. It's everyone on the band seems to lose conditions at the same time, and when the conditions seem more beneficial, they seem to come back. And regardless of different antennas that you can use, sometimes it'll reduce some of the background noise, but I've not necessarily seen where on different times of days, if I use one antenna, I'll give somebody a better signal than another day, other than just being able to sometimes change the way I can cancel some noise, like especially in the summertime when there's more electrostatic interference in the air. Certain antennas are better to listen on just because I can quiet some of the noise down a little bit, and I can pull out the weaker stations. But generally, have I had the experience where I can say that by using one antenna where on one day it's good and on another day it's bad, and vice versa against two antennas. I've never had that situation, Dick, where I can honestly say that one antenna was better than another antenna on a specific day and then on the next day that it came back. There again, and I'm not saying that that's not possible, it's just that I've never experienced it so far. It's that I might, you know, have to experiment with more antennas longer before I could prove that one out. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
I got one other guess here, Glenn, and that is when you adjusted it for the mode where you made the local grounding current go to zero, and it seemed to be a useless mode to you, where nobody heard you. Is it possible that when you fed the antenna that way, a lot of your radiation now was straight up, near vertical infinite sky wave, and because of the state of the ionosphere, that signal was just going through the ionosphere, going out, never coming back, nobody heard you? You were creating 100 watts. You weren't radiating that much of it by your feed line. Your antenna tune is running cold, so that power was getting into the antenna. And about the only way I can think of that the antenna could radiate that power but nobody hears you is that during an unfavorable day, you sent it a near vertical incident sky wave straight up, and the atmosphere wasn't reflecting it, therefore nobody heard you. Is it possible that was going on then, Glenn? What do you think? KQLIW.
Should I wait for a B?
Your choice.
Okay. I kind of think that that's what's happening. It was either, like you're saying, a completely vertical pattern where it was just burning the sky, so to speak, a real cloud burner, or it just wound up in a pattern that wound up into a local ground someplace, or just got absorbed in an area where the antenna was acting very similar to a dummy load kind of an effect, because not only could nobody hear me, but I couldn't receive anything as well. It got to a point where it was just, everything got quiet. In fact, that was the first area of concern, especially when you're listening to the low bands, like on 75 meters. If you get a tuning, and all of a sudden you find out that, you know, the match looks great, you transmit the current looks phenomenal, but all of a sudden it's just darn too quiet for the receiver. You kind of realize there's something not quite right there. Now, exactly, was it completely vertical, or maybe the pattern was just into something metallic nearby that was just, you know, absorbing everything. So it was somewhere along those lines, Dick. But there again, I couldn't prove it either way. Back to you.
I encountered a phenomenon exactly like that. I have formulated in my mind some sort of theory, but I cannot prove it. But if anybody wants to listen to it, I'm ready to share it with you. Radik?
Fascinating. Yeah, I think I want to hear it. I was about to offer Glenn some suggestions on local field strength readings to find out what polarization and what amplitude and what directions was being radiated. To radiate a signal to get a good standing wave ratio to an antenna that's high up in the air, and yet the antenna is quiet and nobody hears it, that's a paradox. I mean, if the antenna is giving you a low standing wave ratio, you've got a good impedance match between that antenna and the instrumentation in your shack. That means the antenna is capable of radiating. That's the only way it can give you low standing wave ratio. The antenna is radiating, but yet you pick up no noise and nobody hears you. And maybe Nevis explains that, near vertical incident sky wave, because straight up and down, the ionosphere is transparent, the signal is going out into space, doesn't come back, and there's no source of LIPA power line noise in that direction. Maybe that's why it got quiet. Let's see what Alex got to say on this one. N2NNU, K2LIW.
Okay, let it drop it. I couldn't stop not to throw in my 2 cents, because this is something that I'm fiddling around for about 2 years now, and I think I have something in my mind, not sure, but I have to verify theoretically and mathematically. I think what happens is that the radiation angle of the antenna is changing with the declination of the location. In other words, because Because the magnetic field of the antenna interacts with the magnetic field of the Earth, and certainly in certain places it will hit a declination that is really throwing it off the path of the pad. You will never get it back, and nobody will hear it. That's my opinion here. After so many months thinking about it, I think that's what's happening. Back to the
Yeah, I'm having a problem with that one. Once you create a radio wave and radiate it from an antenna, the pattern with which you radiate it is a pattern it's going to have in free space. Local magnetic fields interacting with the ionosphere can change polarization of the signal by way of Faraday rotation. But the magnetic field of the Earth is a DC magnetic field. It is essentially a steady state magnetic field. And of the electromagnetic wave you're transmitting, its magnetic component is going through a cycle 3.7 million times per second if you're at 3.7 megacycles. So I'm having trouble believing the steady state magnetic field of the Earth can do anything to change the pattern of the electromagnetic wave your antenna is transmitting. Yes, it can change polarization by way of Faraday rotation through that plasma called ionosphere. But that's not changing pattern. That's changing polarization. If I've got a lobe, because of the height of my antenna off the ground, I've got a lobe that's transmitting a strong signal toward London at an elevation angle of 30 degrees, and if I haven't done anything to change the pattern of that antenna, but there's some strong magnetic field in that direction, I don't think it can change that pattern. That's my belief. Back to you, Alex.
Let me say something about all this, Dick.
Okay, let's go to Mel first. We haven't given him 2 cents worth in the last 20 minutes. He's been sitting there chewing his nails for 20 minutes. Go ahead, Mel. Wait for the beep.
Okay. All the experiments I've been doing with that receiving antenna for the last couple of years on 75 meters has showed me something that is somewhat unbelievable at times. At first, of course, questioning whether something was going haywire completely, because you remember when I first made the statement, I felt like, am I going to really put this out on the air, that I'm using this 12-foot diameter, diamond-shaped antenna sitting in a shack on a tripod, and I'm receiving at many times better than my 272-foot full-wave loop that is 45 feet up. And the answer is yes. In fact, many nights when I get off my friends on 3820, I start hearing California. Now, usually California starts to join us around 1 o'clock in the morning. I start hearing them earlier if I get the loop set exactly right. They don't hear it. I have many times set that loop, you know, by keeping it moving. How I find that many times the setting the night before for the same stations that I talk to is completely different from night to night, the tilt and everything, and the way the loop angle is set. In other words, I'm able to do the, you know, set it either in, I can think of call it sort of like an ACL. I can actually tilt it or rotate it, so you can call it that, basically. But the effects are so strange at times that I will be copying them 5 times, and they'll say, gee, I barely hear you, and and I'm still getting good 5-9 copies. Besides, I can say most of the time bring the noise level down to a terrifically ridiculous low on a band that is really most of the time extremely noisy, Dick, over.
Yeah, I think we've almost figured out what's going on there, because that loop in the shack, you have complete freedom of setting its azimuth, elevation, and polarization. You've got complete tunability.
Kinetic antenna?
That's his loop antenna in the shack, Jeff. Is that what you're asking about, Alex?
No, I think he has a magnetic antenna, not a RF antenna, a magnetic antenna. He is receiving the magnetic field only.
Yes and no. He is thoroughly resonating that loop. The loop stick that's in your AM radio, your transistorized pocket AM radio, a person could call that a magnetic antenna, as opposed to the whip that comes out of my handy talkie. Some people will call that an electrostatic antenna. Well, the rubber duck antenna out of my 2-meter handy talkie is a quarter wave ground plane. Yes, it's a little bit more E field sensitive than H field sensitive, but it's launching a complete electromagnetic wave. I will admit that ferrite loop stick on your AM radio, if you were transmitting with it, is launching a more magnetic wave than electrostatic wave. But as soon as that wave gets a fraction of a wavelength away from the radio that I'm transmitting it with, it straightens itself out in space, and it's a true electromagnetic wave. Yes, locally, I'm sensing it magnetically. So is his antenna magnetic sensing? I'm pretty sure your loop is getting really resonant at 3.7 megs. Isn't that true, Mel? K2KEY?
Now, well, I said it before. I can adjust the variable tuning capacity, of course, down on the bottom. Whatever, I can cover the entire 80-meter band with it. No doubt that it's very sharp tuning. You know, that variable capacity is just really can peak it. That was what surprised me initially, how well this thing peaked. It's quite amazing. I never expected the result from this receiving loop that I get. It's just pure fucking magic going on there, because, you know, how can you possibly, in your mind, come up with an antenna of that size, and it's going to, in most cases, either equal or better than a full wave loop outside in free air there. I mean, you know, it's hard to rationalize a thing like that, but it surely is working, and I've had to, you know, explain to a number of people the experiment. Few of them have duplicated that antenna, and also said that it's like a, where's the secret in hiding? Like I said, they mentioned a number of times in articles, you know, about receiving loop antennas, but, you know, nothing has really ever been really emphasized as to what they're capable of, Dick, over.
Very high Q inductor with very low bandwidth. That's what he has there.
QQIQ is what's coming?
Yeah, Alex and Glenn in that order. As I see it, Alex, when he is receiving that wave that's emitted by his friend in, we'll say, Philadelphia, that wave bounces off the ionosphere, that electromagnetic wave at 3.7 megacycles, 3.82 megacycles, comes roaring into his backyard in the Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn. Whether he decides to listen to the E-field portion of it, or the H-field portion of it, or the whole damn wave. I mean, when he's using his full 270-foot diameter or circumference loop antenna, is he listening to the E, the H, or the combination? Most of us will think it's the combination. With his loop antenna, he is emphasizing the local H-field. I'm going to give you that. But it's an electromagnetic wave got to him from space, and he can decide locally which portion of it he feels like picking up, which one is more convenient for him mechanically, to pick up the E, the H, or the combination. And I think no matter which one of the three he picks up, I think it's legal in either case. And some methods are easier to do than another. Let me see what Glenn's got to say on this, and I'm going to turn it over to Alex in that order. Glenn, go ahead.
Well, my feeling is much simpler than all that. I think what would happen is if you take a loop antenna and you take an L and a C and put it on the end of the loop antenna, nobody in the world is transmitting on, let's say, 3.800 megahertz on 75 meter band. and you tune that, and there's nobody transmitting there, and you create the peak, there's enough electrostatic energy in the background where you can create a peak on that antenna, and if you have a sharp enough receiver with enough sensitivity, you'll actually receive something that looks like a carrier at that frequency, just because the narrowband filter will actually draw the energy from either side and create some kind of a local carrier there. Now, if somebody's transmitting somewhere, you know, in a noisy condition, where there's noise on both sides of the band, their modulation now component starts adding to the top of that high-Q signal, and then the receiver is just detecting that high-Q signal riding on top of that resonance. That's what I think is happening with that KC2-QIQ.
Okay, one of the experiments I did that's close to what you're describing, Glenn, I took a receiver that had nothing connected to the front end but a dummy load. And a receiver that's got a reasonable amount of gain, no signals going in, so the automatic gain control is wide open. The receiver's running flat out in gain, the RF gain control set up all the way. And I had an oscilloscope connected to the IF strip, so I'm seeing broadband noise in the IF strip. Now, by way of the Q multiplier, I can peak up the center frequency of that. Let's assume that the IF strip goes from 455 to 460 kilohertz. I can decide to peak up the signal at 457.25. And if I set the Q multiplier narrow enough, just before it breaks into oscillation, the broadband noise in that IF strip becomes almost a pure CW tone, as if somebody had pressed down the key of a transmitter. So whether the broadband noise is coming into the antenna, or whether it's from Mother Nature's space, or whether it's coming from all the tubes of gain in my receiver into the IF strip, if I've got broadband noise, and if I've got a high enough Q antenna, I narrow up that signal so that nothing is left except that very narrow band CW-like signal on an oscilloscope. It'll look like a pure sine wave, slightly ratty sine wave. And if I listen to it with a set of earphones, it'll sound like a slightly hissy CW tone. Is this close to what you were saying, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's kind of my feeling. And my feeling is that if you wind up with that kind of a condition in the antenna, and now you've done like Mel has, you know, he's already created that condition. Now he's moving that loop antenna around, and he's moving away from the local noise sources like the static bursts and other things that would normally be outside of that exact frequency that are actually causing the cover-up of noise of that signal. He moves it around. He gets a nice position where he intersects that signal through the antenna, whether it's more prominent in the D or the H field, the way that it's actually detecting through that loop antenna in that field. And then he just gets enough of the signal riding on top of that to modulate to get over that hiss that you're talking about, and then the receiver is doing the rest, detecting the audio the best that it can, and tuning out what would normally be an extremely low signal in the back of a lot of cloudburst type of noise, whereas now the cloudburst noise is no longer there, but it's actually getting a real signal riding right on top of that quasi-resonance that's been created because of the high-Q network.